from that brief story, there are some things to be learned. So, even at risk of repetition, I would like to relate just exactly what did happen in those very early days. And I feel there is a lesson to be learned, and one that we must never forget if we wish to maintain paid-up insurance policies against our drinking. You recall the story about Bill having having had some spiritual experience, having been sold on the idea of attempting to be helpful to others. You undoubtedly recall the fact that he had been working quite hard at it for around 5 months or so, almost incessantly, and still had not created, if you please, a single convert. Not one. As we express it, no one had gelled. But he had worked tirelessly, with no thought of saving his own strength or time or anything. But nothing seemed to register. When he came out to Akron on this business mission, which perhaps for the good of all of us turned out to be quite a flop, although he had the thing licked but didn't know it, he was tempted to drink, and he was pacing up and down the lobby of the Mayflower Hotel, wondering whether he better buy those 2/5 of gin and be a king for a night, as he expresses it, or not. And his teachings led him to believe that he possibly might avoid getting into difficulties if he found some alcoholic on whom to work. Spying the name of our good friend Reverend Walters on the bulletin board in the lobby of the Mayflower, he called up the good doctor and asked him the names of some of the group of people with whom he had been affiliated and through whose instrumentality he had acquired sobriety. The good doctor said he wasn't one, but he knew of quite a number, and he gave him quite a little list, I guess about 9 or 10 of them. So Bill starts to call them up. Without very much success. They were, had either just left town, or they were just leaving town, or they were having a party, or they had a sore toe or something. Anyway, he came down to the end, or at least very nearly the end, and his eye lights on the name Mrs. and happened to get our good friend Henrietta. But he called up a good Henry and told her what he wanted, and she said, come right out and have lunch with him. So out he went, and went into his story in considerable detail, and she said, I have just the man for you. So she rushes to the phone and calls up Anne and tells her that she has just the power to be helpful to Bob. We should come over. And he said, well, I guess we better not go over today. But Henry is very persistent, very determined individual. He said, oh, yes, come on over. I know it'll be helpful, Bob. Well, and they didn't think it was quite wise for us to come over today. And finally, Henry bore in to such an extent that she had to tell her that I was very much in the sack and has, in fact, had passed all capabilities for listening to any conversation, and it would just possibly have to be postponed, so she stops in the next day. Having invited, being Sunday and Mother's Day, then we said that our aunt said we would be over. Well, I don't ever remember a feeling much worse. But being very fond of Henry and having said we'd go over, we started over, and I extracted the solemn promise, man, on the way over that 15 minutes of this stuff was top. But I didn't want to talk to this mug or anybody else, and we'd really make it snappy. Now, these are actual facts. We got there at 5 o'clock, and it was 11:15 when we left. Now, you know, or possibly your memories are good enough to carry you back to certain times when you haven't felt too good, and you can easily visualize the fact that you wouldn't have listened to anybody unless that individual had really had something to tell you. And that's the way I felt about Bill. And I recognized the fact that he did have something, and so I listened those many hours. And I stopped drinking immediately. But very shortly after that, there was a medical meeting in Atlantic City. And I developed a terrific thirst for knowledge. I had to have knowledge. So I would go to Atlantic City and absorb lots of knowledge. I usually mention the fact that I incidentally had acquired a thirst for scotch, but I didn't mention that. But anyway, I went to Atlantic City and really hung one on. And when I came to, I was in the home of a friend of ours in Cuyahoga Falls, one of our suburbs. Bill came over and got me home, gave me a hooker or two of scotch that night and a bottle of beer the next morning. And that was on the 10th of June of 35, and I have had no alcohol in any form that I know of since. Now, interesting part of all this, and not all these sordid details, but the condition that we two fellows were in. We had both been associated with the same bunch of people. He in New York and I in Akron. I had been associated with them, in fact, for 2 years and a half. He for 5 months. He had acquired this idea of service, and that I had not. But I had done an immense amount of reading, which they recommended. I had refreshed my memory on the good book, and I'd had an excellent training in that as a youngster. They told me that I should go to their meetings regularly, and I did every week. They said I should affiliate myself with some church, and we did that. And they also said that I should cultivate the habit of prayer. And I did that, at least to quite a considerable extent for me. But I got tight every night. And I mean that, some once in a while, it was practically every night. And I couldn't understand what was wrong. I had done all these things that these good people told me to do. Every one of them. And I thought very faithfully and sincerely, but I still continued to overindulge. But the one thing that they hadn't told me was the one thing that Bill had. The instruction to attempt to be helpful to somebody else. So we immediately started to look around for for prospects, and it wasn't long before one appeared in the form of a man whom you all know, at least a great many of you know, a good friend of Akron. Now, I knew that this Bill was Sunday school superintendent. And I also thought that he probably forgot more about the good book every night than I ever knew. And who was I to be trying to tell him about it? And it made me feel somewhat hypocritical. It is quite a job for me to talk to him on that sort of subject. But anyway, we both did, and I'm very glad to say the conversation fell on fertile ground. Then in October, we had three dumped in our lap almost simultaneously. But the point I wanted to bring out was the fact that in my mind, the spirit of service is of prime importance, although it has to be backed up with some knowledge of the subject. I know I used to go to the hospital, and I'd stand there and talk. I talked many a time to a chap in the bed for 5 or 6 hours. I don't know how he ever stood me for 5 or 6 hours, but he did. Probably we'd hidden his clothes or something. But anyway, it came to my mind that I probably didn't know too much about what I was talking. Therefore, we being stewards of what we have, and that includes our time, I was not giving a good account of my stewardship of time. If it took me 6 hours to say something to this man that I could have said in an hour, we'll say, if I'd known what I was talking about, I certainly was not a very efficient individual. And incidentally, I'm somewhat allergic to work anyway. So, I felt that I should continue to increase my familiarity not only with the good book, but read a good deal of good standard literature and possibly something of scientific interest along with it. So I did cultivate this habit of reading, and I think I'm not exaggerating when I say that I have probably averaged to read an hour a day for the last 15 years. Now, I don't say that to try to sell you on the idea that you've got to cultivate that habit of reading an hour a day, because there are plenty of people and fine AAs that don't read very much. You see, back in those days, we were groping in the dark entirely. We did not know much about it. We knew practically nothing of alcoholism. A physician knew nothing about it to speak of. Oh, I'd read about it, but there wasn't anything worth reading in any of the textbooks. And usually the information about it consisted on some queer treatment for DTs. If you'd gone that far, and if you hadn't, why, you prescribed a few bromides and gave the fellow a good lecture. None of which, of course, amounted very much. And in early AA days, we became quite convinced that the spiritual program was fine, but we could help the Lord out a little with some supplementary diet. So, in the early days, Bill, having a lot of stomach trouble, had stumbled across the fact that he got along much better on sauerkraut and cold as Bill had that experience, that probably everyone else would share the same. But of course, we discovered later that the most any dietary restriction had very little to do with the acquisition and maintenance of permanent sobriety. We, in our own stories in the mountain thing speak out, when we started in on Bill, we had no 12 steps, we had no traditions, we had nothing of that kind. But we were convinced that the answer to our problem was in the good book. And it became somewhat evident, we thought, with some of us older ones, that it was contained, the part that we found absolutely essential to a rather limited section of the good book. In other words, the Sermon on the Mount, 13th chapter of Corinthians, and the book of James. I think we got those ideas pretty firmly implanted in our minds very early. And we had in those days, our membership got to 5 and 7 and 10 and still small. Why, we used to have daily meetings in somebody's house. It was probably providentially arranged that all this happened at a time when everybody was broke. And awfully broke, too. It was probably much easier for us to be successful when broke than it would have been to have been successful if we'd had a good checking account to beat. But I know that we were every one of us, just so painfully broke that, well, it wasn't a pleasant thought. But nothing could be done about it, and everybody else was broke too, and so we didn't take it too much to heart. But I do think that that was providentially arranged. But anyway, on having these meetings and having these discussions and attending the meetings of these good people with whom we had been associated, and did continue to have them with them until, in Akron I'm talking about, of course, until about 40, or maybe early in 41. Might have been January 41, I don't recall the exact date. When we outgrew the residence of this good friend who had allowed us to bang up the plaster and the door jams, the counting chairs up and down the stairs, he had a very beautiful home. We had outgrown that, and so we stepped out and in a short time acquired the rental of the auditorium in the King School, and I'm talking about the group that I attend personally, has been there ever since. We attempt to have a good meeting, and I think we're usually successful. But it wasn't until 39 that the teachings and efforts and studies that had been going on were crystallized in the form of the 12 steps. I didn't write the 12 steps. They had nothing to do with the writing of them. I think probably I had something to do with them indirectly, because after this June 10th episode, Bill came to live at our house and stayed for about 3 months. And there was hardly a night in that 3 months that we didn't sit up till 2 or 3 o'clock discussing these things. And it'd be hard for me to conceive that something wasn't said during those nightly discussions around our kitchen table that influenced the actual writing of the 12 steps. Much more handy to have in that form, of course. We had the ideas pretty much, basically, but not in turf and tangible form. We get them, as I said, as a result of our study and effort of the good book. We must have had them because we have learned from experience that they are very important in maintaining sobriety, and we were maintaining sobriety, therefore we had them, but not in exactly the written form as you know them now. But that is the way that things started off in Akron. And as we grew, we began to get offshoots. First one was in Cleveland, and I don't remember the next one, but anyway, they were started in Akron not too long after that, and have been continuing ever since. It is a great source of satisfaction to me to feel that I may have played some part in kicking in my two bits worth towards getting this thing started. I like to think that I have done that. Maybe I'm taking too much for granted, I don't know. But I feel that I was simply used as God's agent. I feel that I'm no different from any of you fellas or girls, except that I was a little more fortunate that I got this message 13 and a half years ago, and some of you had to wait till a little later. In fact, I got a little peeved at our Heavenly Father because he was a little slow on the trigger, because I thought I would have been ready to receive it quite a while before he got around to present it. And that used to irritate me no end, but after all, maybe he knows better than I. But I felt sure that I would have been glad to have anything presented that would have been workable and produced the sobriety which I thought, at least, that I wanted so badly. I used to even doubt that at times. I would go to my good friend Henry and say, Henry, do you think that I want to stop drinking liquor? Henry, being very charitable soul, said, yes, Bob, I'm sure you want to stop. And I would say, well, I can't conceive of any living human who really wanted to do something as badly as I think I want to do it, who could be so total a failure. At any rate, I think I'm just one of these guys. He said, no, Mom, I think you want to. We just haven't found just the way to work it yet. But anyway, that was the way I felt about it. And the fact that my sobriety has been maintained continuously for 13 and a half years doesn't allow me to think that I'm necessarily any farther away from my next drink than any of you people here. I'm still very human, and I still think that a double of scotch would taste awful good. And if it didn't produce disastrous results, I might do it. I don't know. I really love scotch. But I have no reason to think that it would taste any differently. I have no legitimate reason to believe that the results would be any different. They were always the same. They were always the same in that I always wound up back of the dear old eight ball somewhere. And I have no precedent or anything to make it feel legitimate for me to believe that the results today would be any different than they were 14 and 20 and 25 and 30 years ago when I did the same thing. I just don't want to pay that bill, because that's a big bill. It always was, and I think it would be even larger today. Because with what has gone on in the last 15 years, and naturally being a bit out of practice, I don't believe I'd really last very long, and I'm having an awful nice time. And I just don't want to bump myself off, even by the with the pleasures of the alcohol route. So I'm not going to do it. And I'm never going to do it. As long as I do the things that I'm supposed to do. And I know what those things are. So if I should ever get tired, I certainly never would have anyone to blame for it. It would be done, perhaps not with malice aforethought, but it certainly would be done with, as a result at least, of extreme carelessness and indifference. I said I was quite human. And I get to thinking every once in a while, well, here's this Smith guy, he's a fairly smart individual. He's got this liquor situation right for the tail, proved it, demonstrated it, hadn't had a drink for 13 years. Probably could knock off a couple and no one would be the wiser. No, I'm telling you, I'm not trying to be funny at all, because those thoughts actually enter my mind. And I know just the minute they do exactly what has happened. You see, there in Akron, we have the extreme good fortune, as a great many of you people know, of having a very nice hospital set up at St. Thomas Hospital, with a ward that theoretically accommodates 7, but statistics make us see that it's stretched a little bit, and she usually has about 2 or 3 more parked around somewhere. And I almost invariably I find that I haven't been paying quite so much attention to the boys in the ward as I should. Just as sure as that idea that I could probably polish off a couple enters my mind, I think, about the boys in the ward. You've been giving them the semi-brush off here for a few days. You better get back on the job, big boy, before you get into trouble. And I've had a right back and am much more attentive than I had been in the days preceding the time that I got this funny idea. But I get it, and I get it every once in a while, and I'll probably continue to get it as long or whenever I get careless about that one thing. Well, back in those early days about which I spoke, before we had the 12 steps, we did have some other things besides the actual biblical verses. That was. I was getting to thinking more of Smith than I was the ward, otherwise I wouldn't have neglected him. And I wasn't being especially loving when these fellows had come there indicating their desire for help, and I was just a little too busy to give them any or at least very much of my time. Don't want to be bothered with the bird. 10 cents to get rid of him, well, that's easy. You could even stand 2 bits. But not because you love the fellow, but just to be relieved of the nuisance of his hanging on your coat sleeve or what have you. No unselfishness, no love indicated in the transaction at all. But I think that the thing that really counts is really giving a service of yourself, and that almost invariably, not always, but almost invariably requires some effort and some time of your own. It isn't a matter of putting a little quiet money in the dish. That helps, and possibly that's indicated too. But that isn't giving much. That is for the average individual in days like this when most people get along at least fairly well. That type of giving I don't believe would ever keep anyone sober or anywhere near it. But giving of his own effort and strength and time is quite a different matter. And I think that's what is meant by, and what was meant by what Bill learned in New York that I didn't get in Akron. The matter of those four holds good, and I still think that they can be extremely helpful. I have found at times that questions arise and I want to do the right thing, but the answers are not obvious. You don't know what the right thing is. But almost always, if you check it into it carefully, by the yardstick of absolute honesty, purity, unselfishness, and love, and whatever your decision is, checks up pretty well with those four, your answer can't be very far out of the way. If, however, you do that, as I have done at times, and still am not too satisfied with the answer, I usually consult some friend whose judgment, perhaps, I think in this particular case would be very much better than mine. But usually you can do it yourself without bothering your friends about your own personal decisions in overcoming the first step. Can't quite get honest enough to admit that John Barleycorn really has bested us. A matter of absolute purity is somewhat like it. It's purity of ideas and purity of motives and what have you. Non-selfishness includes those things that I've just been talking about. Not the dime of the two bits to the bump, but actually giving of yourself. And as you well know, the absolute love is probably a big word incorporating all three with a little bit more along with it. I think that that is a very difficult thing to have, absolute love. I don't think any of us will ever get it. But that doesn't mean that we can't try to get it. It was extremely difficult for me, and I feel that I never have been very successful at it. It's very difficult for me to love my fellow man. I didn't dislike him, but I didn't love him. Unless there was some special reason, he was just, I was just indifferent toward him. I wouldn't do him any harm. I would be willing to give him a little lift if it didn't require too much effort. I never would injure him at all. But to love him, I just couldn't do it for a long time. And I think that I overcame it to some extent when I was forced to do it. Because I was either going to love this bird enough to attempt to be helpful to him, or I would probably get drunk again. You could say, well, Lawrence, you were just, that's just a manifestation of selfishness. Which is quite correct. I was selfish to the extent of not wanting Smith hurt. So to keep from getting Smith hurt, I would attempt to go through the motions of being helpful to this other fellow. You can debate it any way you want to, but the fact still remains, for the average individual, absolute love is a thing that he will never acquire. I suspect there are a few people who do. Maybe I know some that come pretty close to it. But I think I could count them on the fingers of one hand. I don't say that in a disparaging manner. I have some wonderful friends. I'm talking about it in its finer aspects, and particularly as it applies to AA. I don't think we do anything well very much in this world unless we practice it. And I don't believe we do AA work too well unless we practice it. These fellows that win, break world records in athletic events, people who win titles in the boxing arena, are people who practice it. They've been practicing it for years. Even though they may necessarily be endowed with a lot of physical ability and skill, they still have to practice. And we have to practice to do a good job in AA. And there are a number of things that we should practice. We should practice, as I say, acquiring the spirit of service. We should attempt to acquire some faith, which isn't always easily done, especially for the person who's always been very materialistically minded. And those are the standards of society today, beyond all doubt and peradventure. You have $1 million and your neighbor has $900,000, you're a much better man than your neighbor to the extent of $100,000. And so forth and so on, ad nauseam. But I think that it can be acquired. It can be acquired slowly. I think that is something that has to be cultivated also. That was not easy for me. I just assume it's difficult for others. Another thing that was difficult for me, and I probably don't do too well yet, and that is the matter of tolerance. We're all inclined to have closed minds. They're pretty tightly closed. And that's one reason that some people find spiritual teachings difficult. They don't want to find out too much about it for various personal reasons. One reason is the fear of being considered effeminate, just for illustration. But anyway, the matter of tolerance toward the other individual's ideas, it's quite important that we do acquire it. I think I've acquired it. I have much more of it than I did have, although not enough to hurt me any yet. Because if somebody crossed me, why, I would have to make at least a rather caustic remark about it. Which I've done many times, much to my regret. And later on, I find that the man knew much more about it than I, and I'd been infinitely better off if I'd just kept my big mouth shut. Another thing with which most of us are not overly blessed, and that is the feeling of humility. I don't mean the humility in the sense of Dickens, Uriah Heep at all. I don't mean the doormat variety. I don't think we're necessarily called on to be shoved around and stepped on by anyone, and we have a right to stand up for our rights. I'm talking about the attitude of each and every one of us toward our Heavenly Father. Christ said of myself, I am nothing. My strength cometh from my Father in heaven. And if he had to say that, how about you and me? But did you say it? Did I say it? No. That's exactly what we didn't say. We were inclined to say, well, look us over, boys. Pretty good, huh? That type of attitude. But there was no humility. No sense of having received anything through the grace of our Heavenly Father. Either in AA activity, or socially, or in my profession, well, I don't believe I have any right to get cocky about it. It's only through God's grace that I did it. I can feel very thankful that I was privileged to do it, to have the recognition which I may have received for some activity. But basically, it was only through his kindness. And if my strength does come from him, and these things come as a result of his kindness, who am I to get cocky about it? I should have a very, very humble attitude toward the source of my strength. And I should also never cease to be grateful for whatever feelings come my way, blessings come my way. And I have been blessed, and I've been blessed in very large measure. You know, it doesn't make much difference whether a person is drinking or whether they're sober as far as their ultimate aim is concerned. Whether they're drinking liquor or whether they're not, they're still after the same thing, and that's happiness and peace of mind. I harp about that a great deal because that's what we're all after, and we're all after all the time. We want those two things. We want happiness, and we want peace of mind. The trouble with us fellows was that we thought we could demand that the world give us happiness in just a particular way in which we wanted to get it, which happened to be by the alcohol route. And we weren't overly successful. But when we take time to find out and familiarize ourselves with and put into practice some of the spiritual laws which it is necessary to follow to acquire those things, then we find that we get them. And I think I've had them in very large measure. Those two things, happiness and peace of mind. And I feel most extremely fortunate, and I feel very grateful and thankful that our Heavenly Father has seen fit that I enjoy them. They're there. Anybody can get them who wishes to, but there do seem to be some rules of the game that we have to follow. But they're here and open and free to everyone who wishes to take advantage of them. And by taking advantage of them means a familiarization with them and putting them in practice and incorporating them in our own thinking and action. And we're bound and determined to get certain results if we do. As I said, it is a very great source of pleasure and gratitude to me to feel that maybe I kicked in my two bits left foot at starting this. But as I said also, I feel that I was simply used as God's agent. The question might arise, well, we know what AA's done in the last 13 years, but how about it from here on? Where do we go from here? Our membership, I think, is conservatively estimated at present around 70,000. But will it be in the increase from here on? Well, that'll depend on every member of AA. It is possible for us to do so or not, as we elect. If we fight shy of what the politicos call entangling alliances, if we avoid getting messed up with controversial issues such as religious and political issues, threatened dry problem and so forth. If we know unity through our central office, if we remember the simplicity of our program, if we continue to remember that our job is to get sober and to stay sober and to help our less fortunate brother in doing the same thing, I doubt very much if we shall have any trouble, and we shall continue to grow and thrive and prosper. And I hope we all bear those little things in mind. Maybe there should be some additions to the list, but that roughly covers it fairly well. And I hope none of us will ever forget what I just said about helping our less fortunate brother.
My name is Clancy Emerson, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm glad I keep coming back to AA. My sponsor told me many, many years ago that I would always, there's always something new in AA. And I kind of doubt that a little bit, you know. Last week I had my 31st AA birthday and I got sober when I was 31. Don't know, stop it. Take up a love offering if you must do anything. And I got sober, so I've spent half of my life in Alcoholics Anonymous, being active, I guess. And I thought, what in the world could there ever be new? But I never heard an introduction like Stan's today. Thank you very much. I'll just take up the few remaining minutes here. I'm glad to be here today, safe and sane and sober, because I didn't used to be, and I may not be again sometime. I'm a little nervous about talking on sponsorship. Some of you were present, I know, in Montreal in 1965 when they had a room full of 6,000 people, and I was asked to speak on sponsorship. And I don't know what it was I said, but some guy in the back went crazy and rushed down the aisle, and some of the other people were saying, "Get him, get him." And I don't know who they were talking to, him or me. But if anybody has a tendency to go crazy, head towards the slot. We are here to discuss today the subject of sponsorship, which has been a most important and impressive part of Alcoholics Anonymous for a lot of years. Of course, the first sponsor was Bill Wilson in Alcoholics Anonymous, talking to Dr. Bob and sponsoring him. Some people think that Bill was sponsored by Ebby, and Bill called Ebby his sponsor, although Ebby never went to Alcoholics Anonymous. He said he was too belligerent for that, but he was Bill's sponsor, and he never stayed sober either very long. He had a very difficult time. In fact, some of you may remember, if you were there in 1960 at the International Convention in Long Beach, Bill talked, and he introduced his sponsor, Ebby. And Ebby, that was the first time he'd ever been sober that long in years. And he was about 6 or 7 years sober. He got up and spoke. He spoke briefly, and he talked about this and that. It was like watching living history. Then he sat down. Then he went home again afterwards. And not very long after that, he was drunk again. And some of the people that lived in the city where he lived, I said, how in the world would he get drunk after that, being there with thousands of people and being the sponsor of the founder of AA? And the guy said, Ebby always had a great problem. He never could quite understand why Bill got all the credit and he didn't, because he was Bill's sponsor. Which sounds kind of funny, except it killed him. But that's the way it is with alcoholics. It completely slipped his mind. He did not stay sober. He did not stay active. He did not do these things, and he got drunk from time to time. And when he died, he had just a short amount of sobriety again. Some people in the unknowingly say Bill Wilson really turned his back on Ebby. But what they don't know is that for the last years of Ebby's life, Bill Wilson paid for his hospitals, paid for his rent, paid for his food, paid for his rest homes, because he wanted to do that for his sponsor. kind of a touching little story. But sponsorship, I suppose we could say in the AA sense, starts here at Bill Wilson, has come down ever since. And there have been sponsors for 53, 54 years, now in Alcoholics Anonymous, since July 10th, 1935, of all types of sponsorship. There are schools of sponsorship. There's a tough school of sponsorship, and the just chat and share school of sponsorship, and the do what you think is right school of sponsorship. And they all have some success to indicate that that is right for them. It's hard to remember sometimes that the early days of AA, there never was any tougher sponsorship in the history than those first 5 or 6 years. There was no choice on anything. When you went down to Akron, Ohio, and you went into Dr. Bob's hospital, they'd have relays of men come in to tell you what to do and when to do it. Remember, I heard a little guy talk one time. He got sober in Akron in 1939. There was an army sergeant, profane old goof, came in to his bedside. He said, "Do you believe in God?" "Sorry, I'm not sure." "Well, you got to find a God. No matter what you call that son of a bitch, you got to find a God." Yeah. There was very little choosing. They made him get down by the side of their hospital bed. "We're going to pray, goddammit, pray." It was tough duty. There was no "call me when you come by," you know, it was boom. And in the early days of AA, nearly all sponsorship was strong, tough sponsorship, because no one had ever stayed sober before, and they knew what worked, and they had limited numbers of people. Today, there are a lot of people around AA. There's a lot of loose sponsorship. It doesn't make much difference, apparently, if a lot of them leave and get drunk again, because there's others to fill the chair. But then, there was a few people, and they had to stay there so that we might be here today. And sponsorship has always been a great thing, and yet, on the other hand, sponsorship has always been a bafflement, and it's a bafflement everywhere in the world where Alcoholics Anonymous is. In the last year and a half or so, I've had the opportunity to talk in New Zealand and Ireland and England and Scotland and Canada and Mexico and all over the world. And the one time you question, you always get everywhere you go, What can you tell me about sponsorship? Because everyone would like to be able to do it better. Everyone would like to not lose that person they want to stay sober, not to feel ill at ease when they try to help someone, not to have that sense of, "I shouldn't have done that that way," feeling that makes people like us sometimes feel guilty, like that many times like parents feel when they look back at their children and say, "Maybe if I would have, or if only I would have." I don't know what made me think of this. It's absolutely apropos of nothing. But in the show Mame, you know, Mame sings, "If he walked into my life today, how would I treat him?" She's talking about the boy she raised. She's not talking about a lover. She's talking about the boy she raised. Was I a little too strict? Was I a little too weak? Was I a little too... Because we all have those feelings. But sponsorship is the great gift we have, has been said by some authors in published works, that we have been given a gift that no medicine, no doctor, no psychiatrist, no religious person can have. The conveying of a message that somehow enables alcoholics to stay sober. Unheard of in history, never done. It's hard to remember this, that there are undoubtedly more sober alcoholics in this room today than there were in North America in 1935. There were no sober alcoholics anywhere. And yet, if you are like me, you just take it for granted. So what? And sometimes resentful I may have to go to meetings, I don't feel like it, and do things. So it's an ongoing growth situation for you and me and for Alcoholics Anonymous. It gets down to, if I could just for a minute, talk about why do we have sponsors? What are sponsors about? Is it to... Why should we have to take orders from people? Why should people have the right to tell us what to do? Why do they do that? And why does it help me to do that to somebody else? I think for a minute it might be worthwhile to remember the nature of the disease we're fighting here. We are not fighting drinking problems. If you have a drinking problem, a hospital will take care of that. A treatment center will make you well. A detox will clear you up. And so often we keep falling into traps thinking we're dealing with a drinking problem. Most alcoholics I have ever known have always been confronted much of their life by the feeling, but I'm not really an alcoholic. Not really. I am kind of, and people think I drink too much, but they don't understand. There's something different about me, and I don't know what it is, but I don't know how to explain it, but it makes me crazy. And it sounds funny, but it isn't funny when you're in the middle of it. And it isn't funny when people say, oh, if you do something about your drinking, you'd be all right. And you want to just scream at them, you think drinking's my problem? Why don't you come by my bedroom some morning at 2 o'clock and watch me lie there cold sober and look off in the darkness and just think I'm going crazy and my feelings are terrible and I feel different and I feel people don't like me and nobody wants me and people are crapping on me and I'm so sick of it and I just want... And then you wouldn't think my problem was drinking. You'd think there's something terribly wrong, and I know there's something terribly wrong. I wish my problem were alcohol. I went to my first AA meeting in 1949. I was sent there to an AA meeting, and I was 22. Now, 22 today doesn't sound so bad, but in those years, there wasn't anyone within 15 years of me that I knew of in that state. And they looked at me funny, and I looked at them funny. And they talked about how their problem was alcohol, and I thought to myself, I'll bet it is. I'll bet it is. You know, old fools sitting around saying things like, I drank for many years, and now I'm sober, and I've just never felt so goddamn wonderful. And you want to shout, why don't you tell your face, you know. And I went to AA off and on for years after that. And the one thing that always kept me apart, there were two things really. One was that hideous return to God crap. And I couldn't bear that because when you're a sinful Norwegian Lutheran, there's no returning anywhere. You just keep moving as fast as you can, especially during lightning storms. Oh, there he is now. And, you know, I could go to A sometimes and it wouldn't be too bad. And there's always a meeting about God somewhere. And if you're going to be sincere, you'd have to say, well, I don't believe in God. And after the meeting, some old lady would come up and say, oh, son, we hate to see you fight God. It's hard to keep from saying, well, ma'am, you'll never see me fight God again. You know, just... Now you can just hear me fight God. But God was, even at worst, at best, a secondary obstacle. The prime obstacle is this. My problem really isn't alcohol. I've been in jail 30-some times for drinking-related things. I have been in veterans' hospital. I've been put in a padded cell because I was so crazy drunk. But alcohol is not my problem. I don't know what my problem is. I spent $1,000 in psychoanalysis. I found out one set of problems. Later on, I went deep into metaphysics, cut beyond the infinity of self. It's easy for you to laugh. You don't know how difficult that is. As I often say when I talk, at one time, to the best of my knowledge, I was one of 6 people in the state of Texas who knew truth. And they were so envious, they put me in the insane asylum. You'll hear one of their little Texas friends tomorrow night. When you hear him talk, you think, those kind of people put me in the insane asylum. But why was I not an alcoholic? Because I had an underlying series of emotions that was not due to alcohol. Alcohol was a vehicle I used and discovered that made me feel better. And sometimes I used too much of it. And well-meaning people thought that was the problem. But feelings were much, much more deep than that. There are things like being too sensitive to things all the time and feeling things too intensely and being too easily rejected. A glance sometimes could just destroy a day, a tone of voice, have a lot of anxiety. You've always been troubled by anxiety, big waves of it, when there's no reason to feel anxious. How do you explain that to anybody? You know, it's almost a blessing when something bad happens so you can say, oh, I guess I saw that coming. Jesus, I heard a speaker say the other night, where do we get this feeling of impending doom? From the doom that is impending. You know, that seems relatively straightforward. Well, I've been troubled by loneliness. A lot by loneliness. Now, I know everybody gets lonely, but they get lonely when they're alone. I get lonely in the middle of crowds of people like this. Much of my life,